Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us this morning. We're going to start off by talking about public policy. Our guest is Dr. Peter Marici, who is a professor of logistics, business, and public policy in the Robert H. Smith School of Business in College Park, Maryland, at the University of Maryland. He is a recognized expert on international economic policy, the World Trade Organization, international commercial agreements. Prior to joining the university, he served as director of the Office of Economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission. He's the author of 18 books and monographs and has been published widely in leading public policy and business journals, including the Harvard Business Review and Foreign Policy. And it's a pleasure to have you with us this morning, Professor.
Well, it's nice to be with you.
I've been reading your columns of the last few weeks, and as you pointed out in the most recent article, the G7, the banks, and GE, it's tough to pick out the most significant news of the week when it's all bad.
Yeah, I'm afraid we've been having a plethora of bad news, and it doesn't seem like it's going to get better soon. But that's the way it always is. You know, it's always darkest before the dawn.
You are right that the G7 finance ministers' meeting was significant for what it didn't do, something truly constructive about the credit crisis. They could have taken some action, but chose not to.
Well, the G7 can't take any action at all. It's like the UN or the IMF. It can recommend that people do things. You know, whether we're talking about human rights or bank regulation, governments tend to hold their sovereign prerogatives quite closely. But the G7 has something called the Financial Services Forum, which brings together the senior officials at the World Bank and, at the central banks and at the supervisory agencies that, you know, supervise the banks and this and that, and make recommendations. And they made a lot of recommendations about bank regulations that are quite usual, you know, having stronger capital requirements, extending them to, say, securities firms that engage essentially in banking these days, people like Merrill Lynch. However, there were two paragraphs buried in that 77-page report, one that noted that the banks sold, you know, they bundle loans into bonds these days and sell them to investors, that they sold them, they bought them back, and they sold them again, and they made them very complex and ununderstandable. They noted that. They also noted that a lot of the staff had left town with a great deal of money, because what happened was, you know, a lot of executives would get engaged in this process, and they'd get paid big bonuses for generating all these fees. And if the next year the bank goes bust or the bank loses money on the bonds, well, they've been paid. The money's gone.
They don't get the money back.
They don't get the money back. It's kind of like this. Suppose that, you know, I had a lot of money, and I decided I could make more money betting at the track than I could betting on Wall Street. So I said to you, all right, you go to the track and bet for me. You pick whatever you want. And if you win, I'll give you 20% of the take. If you lose, I take all the losses. Well, even if you're a very good bettor, over time, you're not going to be able to beat that 20%. And that's what was going on. I believe the Federal Reserve has it within its abilities to do something about this, because it is responsible for the large bank holding companies. Has regulatory oversight. But, you know, this report did not suggest that anything like that be done. And the Congress has been very weak-kneed when it comes to regulating the financial sector. You know, they'll write a regulation about redlining or this and that, but they really don't want to deal with the profiteering and the buccaneering that's going on Wall Street, quite simply because that's a very important source of campaign contributions.
If you'd like to join the conversation, all you have to do is pick up the phone in Madison, call us at 263-1890. Everywhere else, it's 1-800-642-1234. That's toll-free. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Please note that those are not the usual Milwaukee numbers, but they are the Madison numbers, Madison 263-1890, or toll-free at 800-642-1234. And our email, talk@wpr.org, as we talk with Professor Peter Marici, who is a professor at the University of Maryland in College Park. He teaches logistics, business, and public policy. You had some harsh words for the former CEO of GE, Jack Welch, who was not content to sit on the sidelines.
Well, my feeling is that organizations ought to be run by the incumbents, not by the alumni. And he was the kind of CEO that was bigger than life. He was bigger than his company, which very big.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Mr. Imlet, who is a very fine CEO in my mind and a very dedicated steward of the resources that have been put at his disposal. And it's very hard for Jack to let go of the spotlight, just as it is for Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan has some more motivation in that he has to go out and earn some money because he spent all those years at the Fed and he didn't earn a great deal of money to take care of what is left of his old age. Whereas Jack Welch has got plenty of cash. And so he's kind of, you know, roaming around looking for the spotlight. And GE did have a hiccup with its earnings. There's no telling whether that'll be a permanent malady or not. But nobody is going, not even Babe Ruth hit a home run every time he went to bat, and Ted Williams didn't get a hit every day. And it is, the General Electric has grown to the point where we can no longer expect super outsized returns from it any longer. It's like a mutual fund that owns too much of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to have quarters where it doesn't make as much as it expected simply because the economy's bad. And the analysts that follow the economy, including Ben Bernanke and myself, are not going to get it right. And just about everybody has underestimated the consequences of the subprime crisis for the first quarter and second quarter of this year. We've all been revising down our forecasts, and also it's a very variegated problem. We have some companies doing very well and some not. Well, poor GE, you know, they're in the financial services business. Don't make no mistake about it. And they got burned. Not as bad as the banks, but they did get burned. And it's not an accident that they were a little off on their profit forecast. But they're still making money. And now it's perfectly fair for people to criticize Mr. Imelt, but it is not. It's not really fair for his CEO, who was such an icon, to come out right on his back and go after him. My feeling is that when you retire from a position, I'm the former chief economist of the United States International Trade Commission. I have never once commented by a decision of my successor.
That's laudable, I believe.
I don't know if it's laudable or not, but I have made it my business to stay out of his business and get about my life and getting on with my next career. And I believe that Jack ought to do the same, and if retirement is the next career, then maybe GE ought to buy him a sailboat without a telephone.
When you read news accounts in various media, some people are saying that GE ought to divest itself of some of its properties. Are you of that same mind?
Okay, GE, you have to understand what GE is. GE is the ultimate private equity fund. It was the first one. GE, long ago, when I was a boy, when I was a young man, the GE executives would say, Peter, GE views itself as being in the business of being in business. We buy and sell businesses. When businesses no longer make sense for us, we buy new ones. And that's what they've done. I mean, they're not light bulbs anymore, and they're not toasters and appliances, and they have sold off businesses and purchased businesses. And the company goes back to the days of Marconi. They will always be in the position where they have to sell some of what they own. For example, the broadcast group might be a good bet right now to sell, mm-hmm. simply because of the changes that are happening in the broadcast industry. If they got a good price for NBC, it might not be a bad, might be a good thing for them to do. I'm not saying they should, but that's an example. But they'll always be in the position of having to shed businesses and acquire businesses by the nature of what they are, which is an investment company.
Peter Morici teaches in the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. If you'd like to join the conversation, number in Madison for you, 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. We do have lines open for you if you'd like to get a call in this morning with your question or comment for Professor Morici. You set out the upcoming economic data of the next week, for instance. We have existing home sales coming in for March on Wednesday of next week. What do you expect to see there?
Well, I expect to see continuing slow market. Essentially, prices continue to fall and are likely to continue falling into the next year. And in a market like that, people are reluctant to sell.
And the following day, we've got new home sales, and do you expect that same trend?
Pepsi and Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're substitutes for one another. My feeling is the builders have to unload a little faster than the people in existing homes by the nature of the financing behind them, and we've had occasional upticks, but I expect to see that market contain rather lethargic for a while. The fact that starts are dropping so rapidly and permitting is dropping so rapidly would indicate that these guys really are having a lot of trouble unloading what they've got. If we see a jump there, it may indicate a fire sale. We'd have to look at the prices alongside it. But my feeling is the housing market will continue to be slow.
All right. Let's take some calls, bring some listeners into the conversation. Tom's in Mequon, and he leads things off. Hi, Tom.
Hi. It seems to me a lot of the troubles that the United States is having, not just lately, but back like 10 or 15 years, is a direct result of deregulation of good laws that kept things on a straight and narrow, and also, you know, the economic times. But my point is, it seems to me that hasn't the banking industry been deregulated since Reagan's era, and now you're seeing the result of it as it did in SNLs, as it did in the housing industry, the aircraft industry. A lot of there's been a lot of damage from too many laws being gutted, and now the people who run these companies, some are not scrupulous. You know, these shysters are doing what shysters are going to do, and they're going to steal if they can.
Okay, well, first of all, don't just attribute it to Reagan. One of the great deregulatory presidents was Carter. He was a businessman and a fiscal conservative. He was a social liberal, but deregulation was as much an invention of the Carter administration with regard to airlines getting it going. So let's make this a bipartisan salad, okay? You know, let's have tomatoes and lettuce if we're going to blame people.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, globalization is inevitable. And our ability to regulate is severely constrained by that. Also, deregulation has given us lower phone rates, less expensive airline flights, better interest on our money. Most of us have lots more choices than we used to have on bank loans. On our deposits. A lot of the problems that we have in banking, we would have worse with a regulated environment. Because, frankly, you can take your banking offshore. And in a way that you couldn't do, you know, when Mr. Carter was president, there was no internet. If you wanted to trade, if you wanted to buy shares in Toyota, you had to get on the, you know, or say a Japanese company that's not listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Toyota's got American depository receipts. But you'd have to get on the phone and find a broker. You'd find the broker in Tokyo, and you'd have to make foreign exchange transactions and over the phone as well to get the yen you need to buy and so on. Today, you can do all that with a push of a button. So my feeling is that we live in an environment where we have to create the right incentives for managers to do the right things, and that our problems relate more to the lack of oversight from Washington and the enforcement of the regulations and the opportunities that we have to bring people to task. One of the things you notice is that one of the best positions in America today is to be Attorney General for the state of New York, because Mr. Cuomo can go after people in a way that the federal government doesn't want to. For example, auction rate securities is a good example of the securities houses being absolutely moral neuters to their clients. I mean, they sold auction rate securities as if they were fixed income investments, and they're not. And they're stiffing their investors rather than standing behind them. Cuomo is launched a major industry-wide investigation. And you wonder where the Justice Department is in all this. I mean, that is certainly interstate commerce. The answer is the Justice Department is sleeping. Now, you can say, all right, that's the Bush people. They're a bunch of, you know, friendly business Republicans. But you got to remember that the people that are really raising money on Wall Street these days are the Democrats. Wall Street's always had a strong Democratic leaning. And you don't see, you know, Senator Dodd and Senator Schumer, you know, hauling up the bankers on this. In fact, you got to remember the Democrats in the Senate have made Mr. Schumer their campaign finance chairman. That is no accident. They want someone who lives where the hay is grown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the hedge funds, they get preferential treatment on taxes. And now there's a scheme to have the hedge funds take the loans of the banks that they're stuck with, the CDOs off their books, and take them offshore. And they would like to do that, but they want the Congress to give them capital gains tax treatment instead of corporate tax treatment if they do that. So they would pay lower taxes than the rest of us would if they took these loans, and basically create a tax subsidy for removing the loans off the books. You know, they might just get that because they've already gotten a lot of benefits thanks to their campaign contributions. My theory about why we're not getting this done is that Wall Street has purchased the Congress, and they're in the process of purchasing a president.
Tom, thank you very much for the call. We're talking with Professor Peter Morici, who is a professor of logistics, business, and public policy in the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland, College Park. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. She'll be back with us on Monday. And we're continuing to talk about economics with Dr. Peter Morici. And let's go back to the phones, and Martin in Osseo is next. Hello, Martin.
Good morning. I would just like to ask two quick questions. Does anybody still believe in Ronald Reagan's theory of trickle-down economics, meaning tax breaks for the very rich to stimulate the economy? And number two, if we have people in this country earning in the billions, do we need more tax brackets? And I'll listen off the air.
Thanks very much.
Well, with regard to the second question, Warren Buffett has observed that his average tax rate is lower than a secretary's, so something's wrong. It isn't so much that we need lower tax brackets as we need to have people really pay taxes in those brackets. The problem isn't the tax brackets for ordinary income. It's the way people avoid paying taxes in those brackets.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a problem. You know, McCain wants to, just to show you that I'm an all-purpose critic. I'm not working for any party. In fact, none would hire me, I'm told. I've been very, very tough on Obama and Clinton for their ability to mow grass on Wall Street. But, you know, McCain the other day talked about, well, we don't need to just help the middle class with this alternative minimum tax. Just get rid of it. Oh, my goodness. The last thing on earth we want to do is not have some kind of minimum tax because of the problem this gentleman, you know, points out. Now, so my feeling is the answer is not just having a 90% bracket like we had in the Eisenhower era. I think that's silly. But I do think we want to see that we live in a world where everybody over 200,000 pays 25% on their income in taxes. I don't think that's unreasonable. Or some number like that, which is, say, the average take of the federal government on income generally, that everybody pays at least the average rate if they make over, say, 200,000. We can debate the number. I still believe in trickle-down economics, and I still believe in helping little people. Unfortunately, the country's become too polarized between the right and the left. You know, when the Republicans are in, they would like, if they could get away with it, to basically practice trickle-down economics. And if Hillary gets in, she wants to tax the living hell out of the corporations and people like you and me so she can buy votes at the lower end of the income spectrum. Neither tactic works. You need to help people that are disadvantaged get the tools they need to succeed in the economy, and you have to provide incentives for people who are creative to do creative things. Overtaxing people or overly disadvantaging people because of who their parents were never works. Our society, thankfully, has a healthy debate, and will always have a healthy debate on those issues, so we never veer too far in one direction or the other, given the directions, you know, public sentiment is moving in at the time. So my feeling is that, you know, it is unfair to merely characterize it, the Republicans in, you know, trickle-down economics and this and that. We do need incentives for people to innovate. In Europe, they don't have those incentives, except in England, really. And a lot of the innovation, you know, a lot of innovative companies are moving to England these days to get away from, you know, continental statism.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Edith in Madison next. Hello, Edith. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. I wanted to ask the guest whether a little while ago when he was referring to deregulation, were you referring specifically to the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which, if my understanding is correct, prohibited the merger of banks with Wall Street financial houses or insurance companies or combinations of any of those?
I'm not a financial lawyer. But the essence of Glass-Steagall was depository banking and investment banking, which is the underwriting of bonds and securities, was separated. In modern finance, it is impossible to have that separation, and let me explain why. If you want people to have 20 and 30-year mortgages, banks have to have the ability to bundle loans into securities and sell them into securities markets. A little bit of history. before World War II, by and large, banks made what were essentially adjustable rate mortgages. They would loan you money for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, you'd have a balloon payment. They were not obligated, so they were less than adjustable rate mortgages, to make you another loan. You just had to pay it off. Essentially, banks made short-term loans, and people would take out successive mortgages. After World War II, we had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all the rest, in which the government and the VA administration made to lower-income people longer-term loans, and longer-term loans became more the style. Making longer-term loans and keeping them on the books of the banks require the banks to have adequate deposits to make all the loans the economy needs, which they don't have, and to borrow short. In other words, people can remove their money anytime they want from deposits and lend long. If banks borrow at 3 and lend at 5 and interest rates rise for whatever reason, they can get caught in a scissor. Welcome to the savings and loan crisis of the early 1980s. That's exactly what happened. The banks were stuck with mortgages that paid too little and had to pay too much to get the money. Unless you want to have regulated deposits and require people to save their money at the bank, something very few of us want, banks have to have the following ability. They loan you the money. They take the loans, they turn them into securities, and they sell them to fixed income investors. The fixed income investors tend to be people who want the money for the long haul and can spread the risk of having to get liquidity out. For example, insurance companies pool all of us together. If the bank's going to be involved in this kind of activity, they're in the securities business. Glass-Steagall's gone. Now, I'm an advocate of considering the breakup of an entity like Citigroup, because it has almost 10% of the deposits in the United States. And we have a basic problem up there. These guys have become involved in dirty underwriting. A lot of the collateralized debt obligations, which are basically mortgages wrapped into bonds, credit card receipts wrapped into bonds, anything they can wrap under the face of the earth, they'll wrap into bonds, have not been really of the quality that they should be. They've been caught at it. The fixed income investors now won't buy their bonds. Well, the bank inside of Citigroup can't make loans anymore, and there's a shortage of credit in the country. It could reform itself and make its bonds acceptable to fixed income investors like insurance companies, but instead, they'd rather go looking for profits elsewhere, and because they're part of a large financial conglomerate, that creates that opportunity. So, in a nutshell, getting rid of Glass-Steagall was necessary. What should replace it is extraordinarily complex, and I don't believe it is within the wisdom of a Congress that is clearly on the take on the campaign contribution side to get anything done. You know, one of the great tragedies that's happened is that we've had the law of, you know, adverse consequences with campaign contribution reform by limiting individuals to, I think it's $2,300 per person per campaign. They have to basically find large number of executives who can give that kind of money. And the only places you can find that really are in the high-tech areas or the creative industries like Hollywood and in finance. And so it gives those industries undue weight in the making of American economic policy. And considering the mess that Wall Street has just created, the Federal Reserve has loaned it $600 billion, which is no chump change. It's about 4% of GDP, to take bad paper off their books, and that the hand of God is not coming down on them for what they have done and the money they have taken is amazing. And it's a testimony to just how effective it is possible for campaign contributions to influence the behavior of both political parties and not just the Republicans. I know that's upsetting everybody in Wisconsin, but all I can do is tell you what I see and hear.
Edith, does that answer your question?
What would
Please do.
I thank you for that explanation. You have cleared the whole thing up for me.
Appreciate it, Edith.
Thanks a lot, Edith. I appreciate it.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, there is a line now open in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Peter Morici, who is a professor of logistics, business, and public policy at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. We go next to Sue in Milwaukee. Hello, Sue. Sue, turn your radio down, please.
Oh, sir. Well,
yes.
We're waiting.
Yes.
I will give give my email address out on the air if you like, and
yes,
anybody who wants to get on my mailing list and get the which you've been viewing through your producers, I'm happy to provide.
Absolutely.
Okay, when it's suitable to you. I go. Do we have this caller now?
Sue?
Yes.
Okay.
Good. Sue, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I have two questions. I've added one because of what you just said. There was some law that was, or not law, but there was something that was passed during the Bush administration a couple years ago that enabled corporations to pay. They shifted all their tax requirements out of the U.S. U.S.-owned companies, if they moved the ownership. They're still U.S. companies, but they removed the responsibility of paying U.S. taxes, and it was like this giant, giant amount, and it passed through the Congress. And I was kind of like, whoa, that is so much money that U.S. corporations are now not putting into our economy. And that's one question. What was that? It was a couple years ago, and I'm sorry I don't have a good explanation of it. And my second one, and I'll take my answer. I'll listen off the phone. My second one is the. It seems like the U.S. economy from post-World War II has really changed, and that our current economy is really failing, and that compared to the growth and the strength we had post-World War II, and now it seems like those investments, those stocks, those U.S. businesses are not the place to invest, but instead to be aiming towards Asia and India. So comparing Asia and India's economy currently with the post-World War II economy, and I'll hang up.
All right, Sue.
With regard to the first question, I suggest we save that for when you have a tax lawyer on air. I really don't know that I can answer. I do know that American corporations still pay a lot of taxes. They haven't taken their ownership offshore. But there have been opportunities to do things like that, and perhaps someone who's a tax expert might be better able to deal with that one.
Okay.
With regard to the second, the U.S. economy has been greatly disadvantaged by the global currency regime. That is how exchange rates are set. Over the last 20 years, in the West, we have moved to a floating exchange rate regime, which permits exchange rates to adjust up and down, like the relationship between the dollar and the euro, for economic conditions to kind of move trade to a more balanced position, and so that everybody benefits from free trade, of which I am a very strong advocate. Unfortunately, the Chinese and Indians and others in Asia have been able to manipulate their currencies by essentially selling their currencies in currency markets and buying dollars and investing them in securities for the purposes of maintaining artificially inexpensive currencies and making their products artificially cheap in U.S. markets and our products artificially expensive there. The Bush administration has been reluctant to do anything about this. The Democrats, while they were in the minority, screamed bloody murder. But now that they're in charge, they're reluctant to do anything about it. And I hate to sound like a one-note Charlie, but one of the reasons is that if you're an American company competing that is trying to export into China, this currency issue is very important to you. If you're an American company competing with products coming from China or India, this is very important to you. And the other smaller countries do the same thing. However, if you're an American company whose primary interests in that part of the world are investing to produce there, then this issue becomes more neutral for you. It's not. It depends on the company. It may or may not be neutral. But what really is important is that the U.S. government doesn't irritate China, because China still heavily regulates inward foreign investment, as does India. And those are the two big bananas. So you don't want the U.S. government to do anything that will really upset the Chinese. Now, who does that translate into the United States? Well, it translates into companies like Microsoft, because their primary interest is intellectual property protection in China. Remember, they don't have to make anything here to sell over there. There's not much to selling hardware. You'd be a little disc is a nickel. The banks who want to establish branches there, you know, they want to establish their ability to take deposits and sell their services, of which they have an enormous advantage. The Chinese know about as much about banking as I do Swiss cheese making, which is none. And Hollywood, which wants to be able to, you know, sell its products there. I have just described for you the backbone of the Democratic Party financially. So you've got, they don't want anything to happen. Now, it isn't like the Republicans don't have problems there as well. General Electric makes half its money abroad now. IBM, 65%. General Motors has figured out that it can make money in Asia but can't make money in North America because of its problems with its union, which are not resolved. As we're reading in the papers today, they have more strikes.
Right.
So you've got a constituency of multinationals that lean on the Republican Party, a constituency at banks and in Hollywood and in the tech area, which tend to be Democratic industries that lean on Nancy Pelosi and her friends, and nothing ever gets done. In the meantime, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you are in the triangle that ranges somewhere between, say, Baltimore, Syracuse, and Minneapolis, what I call the foundry, where Americans make things, you're getting screwed by your elected representative because they're not standing up for you on this issue. And that is why we are not doing as well and why we are having a recession. And why, when we emerge from the recession, we will not grow as effectively as we have. This has been a bipartisan project of both the Democrats and the Republicans in Washington not to give American manufacturers a fair deal when it comes to Asian competition. And I got news for you. While manufacturing may only employ 10% of the workers, now it's actually less. We're down. It's about 10. It's about 10% of the workers nationally. It's where all the R&D comes from. And let me tell you something. If there hadn't been an IBM computer, there would have never been a Microsoft and all that wealth, or a Google in the United States. So my feeling is, you know, it's currency, and it's the campaign contribution system, and, you know, it's a lot of things that have worked against American workers. Ordinary guys are getting a hard deal from both parties.
You mentioned your email address, and let's go ahead and give that now, Peter.
Yeah, it's P-M-O-R-I-C-I at R-H-S-M-I-T-H dot U-M-D dot E-D-U, as in University of Maryland, E-D-U. So it's P-Marisi at R-H-Smith dot U-M-D dot E-D-U. We are very fortunate at the University of Maryland. A man named Robert H. Smith, who's a real estate developer, the school is named for him in recognition of his wonderful generosity. Who, by the way, has been a wonderful donor. He hasn't really tried to influence what we do.
One of the few people who give money and don't try to influence.
Actually, there are a lot of decent people around the country who do give money to the opera and to schools and universities and to the United Way and to food banks and all the rest, you know, having been involved in nonprofit work my whole life. And there are a lot of corporate leaders who get involved in activities where they have some discretion about company contributions, who give money, and as long as you really don't get too crazy, they leave you alone.
Our guest is Peter.
There are a lot of decent people in America. Don't kid yourself.
Peter Marici is a professor of logistics, business, and public policy at the University of Maryland College Park. And by going to his email address, you can ask to be put on the list to receive his weekly comments. And I'm enjoying it, and I'm going to sign up myself and not let the producers get all of the good material. I'm Jim Packard. We'll be back with more calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Glad to have you along with us today as we have an interesting program about policy, economic policy with Professor Peter Marici. An email address came in from a nominee, and let me ask you about this. Would it not follow inexorably from your comments about campaign contributions at the heart of the politics of finance and money that the only real core solution is to move to publicly funded campaigns at the federal level?
Yeah, if you can do something about, you know, I'm not a big guy for government programs, but I've just about had it. I would go along with that if you could give me some answers to some basic questions. How do we deal with the special interest groups right now who are not governed by any limits at all because of free speech? The Democrats are usually advantaged in this campaign because they have people like the AFL-CIO running around spending lots of money, and they have, you know, special interest groups that have sided with them because they're very upset with the White House. How do you keep people from exercising free speech and essentially running surrogate campaigns alongside the actual campaigns that are very beneficial to the candidates? You know, if we could deal with that, and then how do you deal with the fact that, for example, when we begin the process, we have lots of small candidates who might not be recognized by a system of public contributions. If you can help me solve those problems, then, you know, I would be for it. But I don't know what the senator from New York would do then. You know, the New York Times, which basically views all Republicans as evil, and the most evil of them are in public office, used to refer to Senator Schumer's predecessor as the most ethically challenged United States senator. You know, I think because of the campaign contribution system, it is very tough to be a senator from New York right now because of the dependence of that state on the financial services industry and the amount of weight that it can bring to bear on a Democratic or a Republican senator. I mean, I would just love to, you know, to liberate the Senate, the senators from New York.
Let's go back to the phones, Peter, and go to another Peter in Green Bay. Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I wonder if your guest can talk about the origins of the Federal Reserve, fractional reserve banking, how has led to the current dollar value, and how the private owners of the Federal Reserve use their profits to control our government. And I'll listen off the air.
Oh, golly gee. The origin of the Federal Reserve has its origin in several successive bank crises we had in the 19th century. Early in the 20th century, it was decided that we needed a federal system to sort of provide some stability in the banking system. And member banks have to adhere to the fractional reserve requirements of the Federal Reserve. That is, that they have to keep so much on deposit, so much cash in their vaults to back up their deposits and the loans they make. They can't loan out all of their deposits and loans. They have to keep more than they might think they should keep, as determined by the Fed. The Fed makes a profit, but the Fed remits those profits to the U.S. Treasury. Let me explain how the Fed makes a profit. The U.S. economy needs money to run. So every year, the money supply, that is that currency you see floating around, has to increase. The way it does that is it prints it. The Fed prints the money. Actually, the Bureau of Engraving does it for them.
Right.
And they sell it to the banks in exchange for Treasury securities that are in circulation, or they sell it to the public, you know, in the bond market, in exchange for Treasury securities in circulation. So they have Treasury securities as assets, which collect interest from the federal government. They take out from that what they need to run the bank itself, which is not a lot. There are, you know, this is not a massive bureaucracy at the Federal Reserve. And the difference, they just remit back to the Treasury. Now, in the latest debacle, where they have taken back from the banks large amounts of these bogus bonds, or these bonds that are worth less than their face value because they're backed by subprime loans. They're not worth zero. They're worth less than their face value. And they've given the banks Treasury securities in their place. Now, the banks are collecting that interest. And to the extent that the Federal Reserve, you know, loses some money in this game, then that will be subtracted from the interest it can remit to the Treasury. So, but, you know, the Federal Reserve is theoretically owned by the member banks, but in reality, they don't profit from it. The profits go back to us. Because, you know, it was kind of an early 20th century thing to have the private sector own the bank. It really shouldn't.
Peter, thank you so much for your call. And on to Tom in Burlington. Tom, what's on your mind this morning?
Yes, you talked about an earthquake. We just had one here in southeast Wisconsin. Recyrus Erie is a company in Milwaukee here that sells their products overseas, and they've done very well. I wanted to ask about the credit card companies. If a person gets a loan and then he has too many credit cards, then the credit card has the rating system, your credit rating, and they'll tell you, well, you have too many credit cards, so now your credit rating is bad, so now we can raise the interest on your loan. And this seems to have been one of the self-perpetuating problems with the whole crisis that we had here. Could you maybe address that problem?
Well, one of the unfortunate things, the way the world works, is when you owe someone money, if you don't have a contract, otherwise he can change the interest rate that he charges you, and that's what credit card companies do. I mean, credit card companies are essentially in a position where they can call your loan at any point in time by raising the interest rate. It's as if you borrowed money from the bank and there was no term on it. The bank said, well, we'll loan you money at 6%, and at any point in time, you can keep paying the 6%, but at any point in time, we can ask for the loan money back, make it callable, or charge you a higher interest rate. And that is your relationship with your credit card company. people that perpetually live on credit and have large balances are very vulnerable, because right now the banks are having trouble raising money. Because after all, fixed income investors, namely the insurance companies and the pension funds, which happen to be run by very ethical financial people, where people don't make, where 35-year-olds don't make $10 million a year for hustling bonds, they don't trust the banks and won't loan them their money. And so the banks who are behind Visa and MasterCard have to charge people more money so they can pay more money to raise the funds they need, and that's what's going on. And they're also getting very nervous that as the economy slows, these people with these large balances are the most likely to default. Unfortunately, by raising people's rates, they make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. I guess I have always been a very strong advocate of not having credit card balances, that if you cannot finance what you need through the bank on a fixed rate, then God is probably telling you you're borrowing too much money. And a lot of people are in that situation, and you know, there's not much, you know, I can say other than they're stuck.
Tom, thanks very much.
You might not consider it fair, by the way, and I'm not saying it's fair, but if you hadn't noticed, economists are not much in the business of talking about what's fair and unfair. They're about talking about incentives to do positive and negative things.
All right, let's go to our next caller from Ashland. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I had a comment about the issue brought up about Asian currencies, but since then I've heard a few people talk about the Federal Reserve, and I just wanted to comment that this idea that it was created to produce market stability, in my opinion, is a bit of a joke, especially given how much inflation we have. The Federal Reserve is designed to create money. Money creation has gone up dramatically just in this recent period of time, and it's a big reason why we're seeing so much inflation. So this, the Federal Reserve, isn't here to benefit us. It's here to destroy our currency is what it's here for.
Well, let me tell you something. If we didn't have the Federal Reserve, the market instability that we would have had over the last 6 months, you would want to see. We would have had such a credit meltdown if it wasn't for the fact that we had a Federal Reserve over the last 6 months. The economy would have been thrust into something like the Depression without the Federal Reserve. I have criticized some of how the Federal Reserve has gone about this, but to say that it has behaved irresponsibly is silly. The fact is the banks create, the way we really get money supply is by the banks creating loans, and the banks can't create loans, so a lot of that liquidity is just sitting on the banks' books.
But the reason why we would have gone into a depression is because the Federal Reserve created a bubble to begin with.
The Federal Reserve did not create the bubble,
yes,
sir. Let me explain to you the origins of the bubble. By having an undervalued currency with regard to Asia, the Chinese printed lots of yuan. They turned around and sold those yuan for dollars. They didn't hold dollars. They turned around and bought Treasury securities, subprime mortgages, and other debt instruments in the United States, along with other developing countries in Asia, which did the same to maintain undervalued currencies. That essentially dehinged the short-term and the long-term rate. No matter whether the Fed lowered or raised the federal funds rate, mortgage rates stayed fairly moderate in the United States. That caused the housing bubble. It encouraged banks to do very irresponsible things because long-term money was cheap. With regard to inflation, again, the undervalued currency has encouraged growth on steroids in China. Every time a factory job leaves Indiana or Wisconsin and goes to Shanghai or Beijing, the price of oil goes up, because in moving that factory job, oil consumption goes up. Let me explain. When a factory worker loses their job in Wisconsin, they usually take a job in the service sector and they continue to heat their home and drive their car. In China, when a factory job is created, someone moves in from the countryside, stops burning wood, and starts burning oil. They live in a high-rise. They have air conditioning. The factory itself uses electricity much less efficiently than the factory does here, actually generates electricity less efficiently. The Chinese power grid is inadequate. So oil consumption goes up. The pace of growth in China is encouraging very rapid adoption of the automobile as a means of transportation, and the Chinese subsidize the consumption of gasoline and subsidize the importation of oil. That has driven oil prices to $115 a barrel. That is much more inflationary than anything else the Federal Reserve has done. Likewise, the Chinese are absorbing a great deal of steel. They're consuming four times as much steel as we do each year, which is driving up scrap and ore prices. They're driving up lumber prices and all the rest. An undervalued an overvalued dollar vis-a-vis Asia causes growth that the resource sector of the global economy cannot accommodate. And it is the primary source of resource-driven inflation. Not to say that we don't make our own mistakes here. Let me give you a very good example. We have decided we're going to feed our cars corn. That is a very popular notion in the U.S. Congress because of the strength of the farm vote. The trouble with that is ethanol is a very inefficient way to solve our basic petroleum consumption problem. There are better ones. But it does drive up food prices because, as you know, living where you do, corn is a substitute for soybean, and soybean is a basic feed crop, you know, basic feedstock for people, and for animals and so forth. We're driving up the price of food dramatically with the ethanol program, as is the growing prosperity in Asia because people are eating more meat, and it takes three or four times as much grain to feed people with meat as it does with grain. So please, Ben is a very smart guy, but he's not smart enough to cause all these problems all by himself. But I mean Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Alan Greenspan, in terms of causing a bubble, and yes, I agree with you in the sense, well, especially on the ethanol issue, but this idea that we can continue to get cheap goods from China, at some point China's going to figure out, hey, we might as well just consume this stuff ourselves. After all, we have 1 billion people. Why send it over to America and completely destroy our currency in the process? They're undergoing a lot of inflation. I mean, they're basically subsidizing us. And at some point, they're going to figure out that's nonsense.
I sure wish they would do it sooner rather than later, because as soon as they do it, we'd have to make the stuff ourselves, which we're well capable of doing, and that would get our economy going again. I agree with you there.
I read, Peter, that in China, almost all of the goods that are bought and sold there are counterfeit. And what does that add to the equation?
Well, I don't know whether all is useful. Anybody that's listening here that has children, that has teenagers in the house, has probably got a felon in the house because, after all, they've got some pirated software. In the United States, though, probably the good folks at Wisconsin Public Radio, just like the University of Maryland, pay for their software. I mean, all my software is paid for at school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we pay, get a reduced rate, but we do pay for it. Over there, your basic problem is your businesses are stealing the software as well. And that applies to a lot of things that go on over there. In China, they have very good intellectual property laws at the national level, but they're not well enforced. And it has to do with the legacy of the communist system and that they don't have a very good system of business law and business law enforcement. In the United States, when we established the federal government, we established federal courts. In China, they don't have a federal court system or a national court. They still have provincial courts the way we have state courts. But it's the state courts or the provincial courts that have to enforce national law. China's a very big country. Many of the enterprises are small. They're regional employers. China's a country of small companies. Very often, the pirate is a small company in China.
Mm-hmm.
As a consequence, if Microsoft brings a case, it's in a local court asking for relief from a local company that creates jobs. It is very hard to win your case in a situation like that. I liken it to the following situation. Suppose you send your kid to a private boarding school. Your kid gets in a little bit of trouble. The school decides to throw him out, but suppose you think they're excessive. You try going into that small town and getting the local judge to reverse a decision of the private school. You're just not going to get it done. It's a very similar problem in China. It's a terrible enforcement problem for which there is no ready answer. Now, what I recommend companies do, and what they are doing, is as they establish over there that they make friends with local officials. That gives rise to the kind of problem I was talking about, where they become more invested in their relationship with officials over there than they do with their relationship with their workers here.
Got an email from Betsy. Thanks for the guest. I want to be on his email list. He speaks with the voice of reason more than anyone I've heard. I hope someone hires him as Secretary of the Treasury. So my question, how do we evaluate the campaign baloney we hear from all of the candidates? Do any of them have a coherent message? And if somebody wants that, I guess they can just go to the website and they can read your story about McCain confirms GOP out of ideas, but so are the Democrats.
Well, right now, I mean, by the nature of American campaigns, you have to talk, you know, briefly because there's so many different issues, and that gives rise to people pandering. like, give you a good example. So you don't think I'm just beating up on the Democrats this week. I was wholly disappointed when McCain said, well, we ought to forgive the gas tax for the 90 days during the summer, you know, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, which is about 90 days. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. We are paying too much for oil. However, it's silly for us to insulate ourselves from the global price of oil. Rather, we should adjust to it. And by that is by coming up with alternatives, which we are now capable of doing. When I was a young man in the Department of Energy, I like to tell my students, back when I was a boy, we would talk about people giving up their Explorers and having to get in Chevettes. That isn't the case anymore. We can build big cars that get great mileage. We just have chosen not to do it. And for a variety of structural reasons inside the automobile industry that we could fix. Telling people to, you know,
Dr. Marishi, I have to break in because we're running out of time, I do want that email address to be out again, and I have it as morici@rhsmith.umd.edu.
That's it.
Okay. Thanks much, and we will look forward to your next appearance with us.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks. Peter Marishi is Professor of Logistics, Business, Public Policy at the University of Maryland. And again, you can get on his email list by going to PMORICI@rhsmith.umd.edu. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network.